lot of the guitar players often have to do double duty. It was the one time where I could go, well, I'm capable of more than just drooling and playing one note at a time. So let me see. And lo and behold, it worked.
We are here today with the legendary Sean Hurley, busy session and touring Los Angeles bass player. And I am such a fan. I wrote down all of these names. Are you ready? Are you ready to feel embarrassed? And yeah, here we go. Yep. Lana Del Rey, Lizzie McAlpine, Alanis Morissette, Ringo Starr, Robin Thicke, Alicia Keys, Gwen Stefani, Jason Mraz, the list goes on and on. But what we are here to do today is talk to Sean about these iconic bass lines of John Mayer. And we have them queued up, and we are going to break them down. Some of these bass lines have been played by David LaBriere. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Sean,
correct.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Correct.
Okay. Yep. People call him De La. Of course, the great Pino Palladino, and some by Mr. Hurley himself. So I think we're going to get right into it. Sean, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Scott, you have these tunes queued up, right?
I've got them queued up. We've got maybe like five or six of them as well. So what we're going to do is we're going to jump straight into the first one, which is No Such Thing. When was this? Anybody know when this was recorded? Because obviously this was Dave on bass, right?
In yeah, the original. Totally. It's probably 2000 or 99. I'm going to guess 2000. I have since worked with the producer that did that record, this guy, John Alasia. So I got a lot of details at the time it was kind of happening, but I never saw it go down, so I could have my dates and places wrong, but it was
I think the record
pretty
came
early.
Out in 2001.
Right. So they probably recorded in, you know, I don't know if it was, you know, 6 months prior to the release or
right.
what have you, but yeah. but it's pretty early aughts.
Ooh, see, Hurley's got the deets. He's got like when they went into the studio. I love it.
You got to do all the research.
Of course. And you've played on this, or you played not on the record, but you've played this
right.
tune with John
we
before.
We played
yeah.
this live many, many times. Probably not every night that I toured with him, but, you know, at least 75% of the time.
Oh, well, let's check out the bass line.
Let's check
it
out.
And then, hopefully, Sean, you're going to play it for us. Let's check it out.
Okay, Scott, hang on. I mean, this bass line is so active, right?
So active, beautifully
super
active.
Super busy, yeah.
Yes, but almost this sort of like, there's melodic ideas happening. There's all kinds of stuff happening on this. There's sort of, you know, pentatonic, maybe Motown-y figures going on.
Yeah, and I get somewhere between McCartney and Motown is where I'm hearing it. Because it's all allowed because it's an acoustic guitar song. So there's that wide open lane. You know, if you have power chords going, this stuff doesn't fly.
Mm.
But this is special because the sonics are like, we got this hole and the melodic range of the bass, kind of from the E here, even low E, but up to this E on the 14th fret of the D string. So sweet, so lyrical.
Yeah.
You know, and it keeps everything going because the chords that John's playing are a little, they're kind of simple, but they've got a lot of little nooks and crannies, a lot of diatonic stuff going, some open, you know, it's an E, so there's a lot of open string stuff potential and chiminess. So then the bass kind of weaving throughout. I always thought it was kind of perfectly composed, and
yeah.
that's why when I heard it, I wanted to mark it like, hey, what's the note for note from the record? Because again, because I meet producers and artists, a lot of this stuff doesn't happen by chance.
Mm.
So if, you know, you record it, you do have the option to re-record something if you don't like it. So anytime I heard a line or even the intro, it's like, strap in your seatbelt. We're going
yeah.
on a bass ride.
Right, right. Yes. And so when you would perform this, were you down to the letter? I mean, were you transcribing this and playing it exactly the way he played it?
I tried to. What I made a purposeful note to not write charts to learn John songs, because while I do that for every other gig I do it on every session. I didn't want to be chained to him, because there's a moment that happens where you're going, I'm a chart man or I'm a memory man. Right. And the minute I write a chart, I'm a chart man. And it takes a lot longer to get off it. But with John, I knew I had time. You know, he had asked me to tour months in advance. So I said, great, I'm going to get prepped and ready. A lot of this stuff was being played in our house anyways. My wife liked the music. I liked the music. So it wasn't that hard to kind of connect the dots of like, what was that chord I kept hearing, but I didn't grab my bass? All right, yeah, that F sharp thing. And then I made a point of, hey, learn it note for note. Make sure I'm capable of 95% accuracy, and then check out the live video, see where the variations can occur. It wasn't, you know, the entrance was not negotiable. That had to be. De La's playing it like that in that clip. And then some of the other stuff, you know, some of the little moving and grooving on the E stuff that would be. That's that you could do a little bit of going off the script on there, but very little. It, like you said, you recognize the pentatonic stuff, so you get your kind of rails on everything, and anything you do within that is going to feel correct. Because again, my audience is never the audience. My audience is the artist and the other bandmates.
Ah, you're not playing necessarily for the room.
I'm trying to give them the best show they could have by giving the band the best bass player they could have.
And that's
best representation. Like, some songs are easy to know. I guarantee you, the next take they did, they changed this or whatever take. If you heard the unreleased takes, they'd all be different. This one, to me, seemed like they came up with some 90% of the lines, and then it was like, hey, did we get it on this take? No, let's try it again. Okay, sure. Let's try it again. I guarantee whenever De La came up with the intro or how he entered.
Oh, yes.
That one, whenever he did it, it's like, great, what'd you do? Do that every time.
That's the way
I hear it. I did not confirm that with anybody, but when I hear a line like that on a record, I'm like, you don't sneak that by anybody.
it's a force. It's announcing your presence.
And everyone, right, the artist and the producer have to go, love it. And then it maybe, you know, it's like, hey, man, went on the C sharp. I hear that and go, he's not doing any thirds. It's all, you know, flat 7, 5, 4, back to 1. So I would never do anything. I wouldn't do any E's in there. I would go, every time a C sharp came up, it was always kind of sus.
Yes.
And then you got to do that move, F sharp, C sharp, F sharp.
Slide.
On that chord, right. And that's the classic guitar voicing with the, it's got the third and the fourth in it. And then the harmony changes, you know. Black and white. It's got the little E minor moment.
Yes,
it's all right there. You're a fool not to take the easy money. It's all been laid out for you.
Right. Yeah, of course. The path to success has been laid out. Yeah.
Exactly. So I would I wouldn't mess with it.
Yeah.
Could you just play? I know you've played lots of little segments there, and that was amazing. Could you just play sort of like, look, a chunk so people can hear that bass line without the vocals?
Right. If Ian were playing guitar, he'd be starting. And then you got the little Robbie McIntosh live bling, birdie, dan, dan. Then the vocal comes in. Climbing kind of the A-Lydian.
Yes.
Inside the line. Woohoo!
outrageous.
And then the killer drum fill. I mean,
yes. So oh my God.
If you check the scorecard, there's a lot of, I'm getting the vibe and not the exact notes, but because I played it so many times, I didn't even practice it this morning, but it just, it's kind of in there. If you're hearing the song in your head, it's like, it's the pentatonics, it's the little moves, but to me, my safe zones are that C sharp. If I'm doing this.
Right.
And up. My sleeve. Boom.
I mean,
you're
come
safe
in today. You
He's
know,
safe.
I just want to let everybody know, you know, Sean Hurley walks in and is like, oh, I haven't played these songs in a long time. I'm real rusty. And then we're like, you just play a little chunk and proceeds to just play this by memory, like playing the guitar part at first, right. Singing John's line. I'm like, dude, oh, it's wild. When you're prepping something, do you find that you like to be able to play something without, like with the song in your head instead of the song externally?
Yes. Yeah, I've always been that. That was what made sense to me as a kid. And when any other band member or leader would go, hey, that's useful, or hey, how long is the bridge? I just took it like, oh, that can be part of my job. Because ultimately, I think we have the easier job in the band in terms of the technical aspects. Mm. We don't need... I walked in here, I got a DI and a tuner, and I worked with all my friends that have guitar players with two pedal boards that they're changing together. So with all my free time, I just feel like I'm better when I know this song inside and out. And to be able to sing a little bit of it, even if it's the rhythm, just I just feel like I get better the more time I spend with a song. And that can be off, you know, just driving. I'll quiz myself when I'm driving in the car or whatever, especially if I'm distracted, like, okay, how long is that bridge? If I'm working on material to memorize for something, all right, how does that go? Hum the bass line, hum the guitar part, look for my external cues, and just try to have them all in my mind while I'm away from the music.
Yeah, I've got one more question. Just for anybody that's watching you and you mentioned it's just like I'm using pentatonics. You know, like, what were the chord sequence? I know there was a few different chords, but it goes from, like, E major to, like, A major at one point.
This is going to be a good quiz. So, welcome to the real world, she said to me. A, and then up to C. So, E major, A major, up to C sharp minor. And then it's got this, I don't know what other notes he's got in it, but for me, it's an E minor situation that's going
got
on.
Got it.
Which is, that's the first scene change in the song. We're like, we're not diatonic anymore. So the first time you hear it, you're like, okay, let's be on guard. This isn't going to be a 1-4-6-5 pop tune.
Right.
Then the next time around, it goes to that F sharp, sussy major thing. It does E to A, and then the C sharp minor. Up. My sleeve is on the F sharp. It's a classic 90s guitar chord where you play a bar chord on the F sharp, but you let the B and the E ring
top.
Right.
Everybody I played with in the 90s had a song that featured that chord in there.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
Yellow has it.
Oh, yeah, cool.
You know, from Coldplay.
Yeah, yeah.
So for those chords, for anybody listening... It's like the kind of sound I would have heard before I was really playing bass and really knew what I was doing, where I hear somebody playing it. And I would be like, well, I've heard that a million times before, but I'm not sure what the ingredients are to make a bass line like that. And what I wanted just to sort of like point out is, as Sean was saying, that's pentatonics. That's major pentatonics that you're using on those chords. And it's just a really great practice to get used to, you know, where they are under your fingers. So, you know, when you're playing as we're playing these chords here, you can just, you know, plug these pentatonics in and really use the fingerboard. I think really
great. That helps you do the variations, because if you learn the thing I do like to encourage myself and anybody else to do is learn the song, learn the bass line exactly, but then do a little bit more digging and going, okay, if for some reason I have a brain fart and I don't know the exact line, what are my building blocks? So sure. If I know that it's E major,
exactly. Yeah.
And that pentatonic stuff, I even pulled out my old Mel Bay method book that I learned from, and it's like, you be introduced to these and just, they're sort of walking baseline 101, 1, 3, 5, 6 octave.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you hear that, oh, Jameson's making use of that stuff. And McCartney's also making use of that stuff. Then you fast forward to Mayer, his bass player's making use of that stuff. And the more you hear it, it fortifies. Great. I've got it all under my fingers. E is probably the easiest, but also the less, you can't kind of superimpose it across the instrument because you've got that open string, that fingering doesn't really exist anywhere else. If you're doing it in G, you have a different mechanic to do it.
Yeah.
But it is, to me, that core stuff means you can fly as high as the song will require you to.
Absolutely. Right. Just super useful tools. Mm-hmm. So, let's jump into the next one. What have we got up next? This old
chestnut.
Here we go. You played this a few times, Sean?
I've got my frequent flyer card on this one. This was an always, never leave it off the set.
Right.
Disney went, like, I can remember what
I know, right?
Yeah. So looking at it now, I'm like, wow, he's a kid. Wow. How old was he when he recorded this?
This is almost 20 years ago. This is like 2006.
Sounds so good. Gotta point something out too. Scott, go back to the beginning of this. There's something that happens right at the beginning between John and Pino that I noticed when we were preparing for this that I just love. Like, Pino feels the entrance coming and he is he realizes that his bass is muted. And he runs. He makes like a beeline for his
tuner. I've never seen that. Wow.
Oh, check this out. And John calls him off. John's like, no. Like, it's so great. He's like, no, don't rush. Like, it's fine.
Let's let it
go around again. Watch this. Pino makes a break for it.
Ah.
John's like, no. It's all good. And Pino's like,
I love it.
And Pino's like, thank you.
That has happened to all of us though, right?
Yes.
But none of us have had Steve Jordan playing the Vulture's groove to simmer and go, you know what? Actually, you could relax for a whole minute.
Yeah.
And let this percolate.
It would be just fine.
Wow.
I mean, you know, obviously that's
What eyes on Ian? Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I've just watched that clip a lot. I was like, what's happening here?
I love it.
Mean, yeah, you know, that's the trio, of course, right? It's John Mayer, it's Pino Palladino, it's the great Steve Jordan, and, you know, Pino with that sound, P-bass. And I wanted to ask you, you know, because you have become a very big proponent of the P-bass. I mean, you were one of the guys when I was checking stuff out and wondering about my career, and I was checking you out, and you were saying things like the P-bass is like, you know,
it's
real instrument.
Yeah.
You know, you were so in. And I wonder if that had anything to do with John Mayer, with Pino, with doing sessions. Like, where did the P-bass thing come from for you?
For me, it happened that when I was very young, I was told just, you know, through the grapevine by the older musicians, Fender, vintage Fender. And this is in the 80s, so it wasn't quite as ever present as it is now, but it was still always revered as, hey, those 60s Fenders, nobody made them better. And I happened to buy a P bass, a 63, in like 1988 for $500. So as I was learning to play and was getting better and better instruments, I had one as a freshman in high school. I had a 63 P bass. Unfortunately, it had an EMG put in, which is why it was so cheap. But I used it all the time. I got used to what the P bass, you know, feel was, the neck width and everything. I was trying to learn Jaco stuff. I was trying to play all this jazz bass stuff, and I just didn't. Yeah. I didn't have a jazz bass. Yeah. So, but I really, it made sense to me. It's like, okay, this is my instrument. Then, of course, I drifted off the path. I was living in a smaller region, Western Massachusetts. You don't get a lot of input from. I didn't even know what a producer was. You know, I was just trying to be in bands, like I think all of us when we were younger.
Yeah.
And then as I was getting instruments that were kind of easier to play, or maybe active things. I had a Charvel. I had an Ibanez.
Yeah.
I would record with them, and nobody really said much, but. I don't know how deeply they were listening. Then when I moved to Boston, I had bought a Fender P bass, but it was an anniversary model, 1990. I've still got it. Flame maple top, active pickups, ebony board, no dots. Yeah. I was using that and it was okay. And then one of my friends, a peer of mine, a bass player, referred to it as, oh yeah, you play that P bass light. And it just crushed me. Gold hardware. I was like, ouch. So I put it on my list to make sure I got a real Fender P bass. And at that point, I was starting to buy the knockoff, still Fender, but like the foreign-made jazz basses. There was the one made in Japan for like $400 that I bought in the 90s. All that to say, I moved to LA and I started recording with an active bass. It wasn't even a Fender. And it just was not getting the results that I was expecting, because I was in the room because everyone liked the way I played. And then you plug in and it's just you recording. They've got tracks. A lot of stuff was programmed drums. And my moment didn't, I didn't get a trophy at the end. It was like, yeah, that's cool. And there were little buzzing like, oh, we'll compress it later. Do like stuff to how to fix the tone to make it sit into the track better.
Yeah.
And I was like, man. And then my guitar player who had helped me navigate L.A. handed me a passive P bass. It was a 5-string. It was an earlier, like late 90s one. But just because it was passive and it had that mid thing, I played it. I just recorded, so I knew my part. I recorded again, and everything, the clouds parted, the sun rays came down. Yes. And this is in 2000, and then D'Angelo's record comes out, and I'm like, man, I got to get a P bass of my own. I've got to have one with rounds, one with flats. I got to do this right. Oh, I'm noticing this Pino Palladino, who we all knew as a Ernie Ball Music Man fretless player.
Fretless, like, yes, right, of course.
He's switching over to the P bass, and listen to that Jamerson sound, and this is so cool. So I was right on the beginning of it for the LA scene that I was a part of, that guys were not quite transitioning to it. Pino already had, but he wasn't in LA, so we weren't seeing it happen. And then the flat wounds really had their moment. And I just went all in because I would test this out with a producer. I'd go, I could play this or this or this. And I was getting comments from, that's good. Just play that, whatever. Right. And this was even a 62 reissue from Fender, which they're great. I still have it to this day. I played it on Lizzie McAlpine's record. But it was doing everything I needed to do without me having to just do anything but plug in and turn all the way up, even tone all the way up. I learned from a producer. He's like, where's your tone at? I was like, oh, it's at 60%. He's like, turn it all the way up. I'll handle it. So, for me, I was guided to just give them what the P bass has to offer and then make any adjustments with my fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And once I did that, I started hearing, I didn't want to hear these other, the jazz bass stuff that I had bought a 69 jazz bass that I loved and was bringing to session after session, and it slowly became like nobody wanted me to play it. They may have wanted someone else to play it, but what was getting the results that I was after and the accolades and the pats on the back was me and my P bass.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Well, and I love that you had one. You had, you know, it wasn't like, oh, you bought one later. You started on one.
Yeah, so it felt like going home, totally. I mean, when I was gathering all the information, really locking in my reading, my playing, my harmony, awareness, theory, it was all on a P bass. So it was, and it was a 63 P bass, so I sold that thing when I needed $500 again, which is so dumb. That also cured me of ever selling a bass. I never sold another one after that.
Wow. Is that right?
Because I felt like, man, I'll work to make more money. I'm not selling this instrument to make money. That didn't seem you know, in my wheelhouse. And also, it's not like I was a day trader with it's like $1,000 on a bass. I could find ways to make that $1,000 back versus selling it for $1,000.
Selling
and it's
an amazing
gone.
Instrument. Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Yeah. And do you still play with the tone control all the way up all the time? Is that like your
on every record I do, it's all the way up. Now, live, I might tweak it a bit because in the in-ears, it gets a little bit, but I'm very judicious with it because I don't want to limit what someone can adjust later. Like if it's a little bright later, I would rather let the mix do it.
The engineer can do their thing
rather
than you do something that they can't do anything with.
Exactly. If you give, for me in my world, because I'm doing a lot of building block stuff, I'm doing a lot of different things. I'm not only playing with an artist like Mayer who is just going to say, hey, man, sounds great. I have to account for layers that might come after. And if I only give them, you know, a mushy bass that's like 50% tone, for me, I feel like I'm not planning ahead for what frequency. There's so much frequency masking that comes up that if you solo some of our favorite recordings, you'd probably be shocked at how zingy the bass might be, but the hi-hats, the cymbals, the guitars, the synths, everything else just starts to control us down. But some of that harmonic dirt, that interest, that it's what we're all craving by using these little distortion things and plugins and everything, that's available if you keep your tone a little higher than. But I had to be schooled. I was mixing myself for my headphones, and those Sony 7506s are a little bit hyped in the high, which to me sounded terrible for the bass. So I would bring down the tone, I'd be loving myself. I'd go into the control room and I'd sound like anything like this.
Oh, crazy. Yeah.
And I realize my mix is not the song mix. And there's not going to be that much bass. You're not going to hear it on Sony headphones that have a hyped high end. And they're going to add so many other things. And the producer yelling at me to turn up my tone.
Yeah, because you were like accidentally suppressing his, I guess, how creative he can be on his end, because you're giving him sort of like a fraction of, or
yeah,
like, you know, a reduced version of what he wants.
Full spectrum, exactly. Yeah.
So, and has that played into how you, where you play on the actual instrument? In terms of your plucking hand, because, and I'm sure that other people have felt this before, when you play a P bass with the tone all the way up, you can get like that top end sometimes feels a little,
it is to be monitored.
Much.
Yeah. Like I said, live, if I'm not on in-ears, if I'm playing a gig with friends in a club, I'll roll the tone a smidge. But probably not more than 75%. What it's done for me is that thing is a very loud indicator of, are you in control of what you're doing? So if I'm playing this E and I'm not careful and the tone's all the way up, it's going to reveal you weren't even sure how, like, did you mean to hit that? But if you're in control and you're doing it in conjunction where it should be in the beat, none of that. Again, I don't live in a world where I'm playing alone. So when I hear this, if I'm playing alone at home, I'm dialing back the tone. because it's okay. more pleasing. Yeah. But I know, man, you're going to crack a snare and hit a cymbal or do anything along with me. I like having
the top.
That yep. top end on it, yeah.
And
yeah.
then I have full manipulation with my fingers. Like, I can control a little less high end. I can give it more. You know, if I'm going to do a mimic of a Jamerson line, I'm not talking about mimicking anything, because then I would go, well, what's the prescription required to sound like that guy? But if I'm just doing me, I've heard it in so many tracks. Like, it's just not there when you go listen through real speakers with a real song attached.
Sure.
Yep, it's only in our world that the high end is like committing criminal offenses. But then the minute there's other music, which is where I want to live, I never want to be alone. That's where the tone speaks.
Well, and for this tune, we've got to talk about, for Vultures too, we need to talk about this muting thing, because, you know, I've been wanting to ask you, right? So there's, of course, the, you know, your tone control, but then shaping the note duration, the shape of the attack with either palm muting, or you've got that cool mute on your signature bass here. I mean, let's see this thing a minute, huh?
This I love for, it's the Jamerson moments where if you want to have the muting happen and not limit your hand, because Jamerson was playing, albeit with one finger, he was never doing what we're going to do to play Vultures correctly.
And, yes.
And I will, again, now I'm trying to imitate somebody's tone, so I'm going to back the tone off a smidge for my taste to try to make it more suitable for mimicking the Pino line. But, and I won't use this muting to do it, because to me, you just watch a video, you go, well, he didn't do a foam, he used his hand.
Right.
And I love the flexibility of the hand. It's different tools for different end results.
Yes.
So if you just want to start burning, you put up this thing, roll it back. It's a little subtle versus off.
Got it.
And then
how much
the hand,
do you play with that on, Sean, when you're doing like your thing? Like, is it on? Is it like?
It's mostly off now because the bass is 10 years old and the strings are 10 years old. Track that I want the decay to be less, I'll turn it on. But that is like one out of every 100 songs. I grew up doing the fingers. You know, I didn't realize Jamerson had the foam in. It was not cool in the 80s to put foam in. So I spent my whole life having my hand do all the business. And I like to play with my finger. I started doing this in blues bands in Boston. And I know a lot of guys like to use their thumb. Mm. And I'll do a little combo. But I find, you know, it's like whatever works for you. And there's so much control. I like having maximum control, because some songs I want to start like this.
Yeah.
And if it's getting bigger, I want to be able to go full open. You know, live is such a different beast than recording. And we're watching an amazing recorded performance of the trio. But even Pino's not playing the same line he played on the record, because it's just a trio. So he's filling up different spaces than on the recording on Continuum. There's an organ solo, whirly solo. There's some ambient stuff floating up top. So I would treat it differently. Maybe open up. If I was playing with John live and he's extending the solo, I'm guaranteed I'm not going to do this the whole time. I might be going just so that the difference of those two things, while small through the screen right now, are massive at a Madison Square Garden where there's subs booming. Just if you tuck it, you're really holding back the whole beast. That's the subs are just waiting to explode. And then you do it like that, and it's like, boom, the whole room shakes.
Right.
So you got to think, and I learned that from Vertical Horizon. I was in my small moment, and then I get live, and it's like, what translates, what throws, what... Mm. I don't know how Giacco did it, because he could do these amazing solos in an audience with Joni Mitchell crowd, and I was not able to speak as loudly and as intricately. So I said, well, I feel these subs shake and I'm going to do the things. I'm going to control. Now the amp is the PA and I'm going to control it in a way that is taking that into account as opposed to just me and my amp on stage and right. being oblivious to what happens.
Yeah. Sean, can you play that line? Can you play that line?
Yes.
It's so great. Every time you play it, I'm like, oh.
Yes.
So simple but John's doing this ostinato kind of thing, and you got a beat with the perfect snare drum ever tuned and recorded.
Right.
I mean,
but the way you play that is so intentional, like the way that you're so short on the B. I feel like when I've heard, other people play it, or when I've played it myself, I'm playing doom. You know, I'm really leaning into the B, and you don't.
Right.
It's really interesting.
I mean, that was, if I could only learn one song, it would be Vultures. Mm. And then, because to me, that was the perfect, like, it was not scripted. You can hear that it's total, to me, it's total improv, through composed kind of thing. But it's like a Jameson line, like, tell me where every next note wasn't perfect. Just perfect. So that was one. I've never played it note for note, but I have learned every note for note, and just tried to just let that always swim around.
Yes.
And but it's also, this could be a meme, but Vultures is a feeling. It's like you just have a feeling of what Vultures is. And so for me, I can't remember what I'm doing when I'm doing it. I just know that's what Vultures means to me. And to you, maybe the B being longer, that's what Vultures means to you.
No, it's just...
I like it.
It's so cool just to see how intentional you are. Because, you're talking about learning lines, but you're not just talking about transcribing the notes. You are really hearing the whole thing. You are hearing duration. You're hearing note shape. You're hearing tone.
Right. That is something that incrementally I was instructed on. Little by little, but you don't get it. When you open the old books that I learned from, we all learn from, you go to jazz bands, like, here's the chart. They just write a quarter note. And as a youngster, I was like, a quarter note is a quarter note. They're all the same. Let's go. And then you go, wait a minute. Like, how long is this quarter note? It's up to me, because sometimes that's just the path of least resistance to put, hey, I need you to play this note. And then the next quarter note, I need a different note. But what they might have wanted to write was, a little dot over it, or it's an eighth note, or is it a 16th note? But if you wrote that, the reading of it would be horrendous. So they give us a quarter note. And all of us, what does that quarter note mean to us? I don't know yet. Let me hear your song. Okay. Okay. And then but as a kid, woof. All over my head. I was nailing the note. The jazz band director was like, great, horns, we got to work on this thing. And I had no guidance. And then I remember doing things, auditioning for jazz bands. And I remember I was putting in between ghost notes, and the band director was kind of overseeing my prep for the audition. He's like, these extra notes you're playing, are they on the page? And I'm like, no. He's like, you shouldn't do them. But he didn't play bass. And I was like, man.
He doesn't know.
I was like, I'm going to do them. But for instance, it would be something like in B flat. If this was what was written. Something very like, in a sentimental mood. Or there's one of those in the mood kind of tunes.
Yeah.
So very rudimentary bass line, just accompanying what would be some, horn lines. And I'm like, man, that doesn't swing. So eventually, by the time I'm a senior in high school, I'm playing it more like. all those little in-betweens. And that's what he was pointing out, like, oh, that's not written. I'm like, but the difference between those two is you're either swinging with the band or you're just reading the ink.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, and I mean, you know, I feel like I heard you say something too about ghost notes once where you said, you know, every ghost note people feel, you know, they might not know where it's coming from or on stage. If you're playing a bunch of ghost notes or you're taking those liberties in that direction, it's felt and it really has a bearing on the groove. And so you have to, you know, so many of us, I was like this for so long. I would just play ghost notes all over the place because it felt like it kind of kept me into the syncopation.
Sure.
But man, you know, it's not always the right thing to do. Maybe the swing is coming from somewhere else, right?
You have to be, this is where, if you're just bass centric, like I think all of us, there's certain limitations. I know I have many limitations on my instrument, but there are other superpowers you can develop to, like, I just wanted to be a great listener and go, I don't have to do this. Like, a lot of this alone stuff, I'm going to play a little bit differently than if we're playing on the Steve Jordan hump, a lot of that heavy lifting has already been accomplished. So we can make different choices than if the three of us are playing alone or we're playing with a metronome or what have you. That's why it's essential to play in the real world. If your real world is always playing with program drums, then get at it. Get into it. If your real world is playing with live people, then you got to get into it.
Yeah.
Because that will, I realize, like, a lot of the stuff I was prepping at home, I was not able to utilize 50% of that out in the real world. So then I'd go, well, what am I craving to happen live? And that's where, you know, producer would mention note length. And I remember the first time Robin Thicke told me to shorten a note or something, I was like, that's interesting. You know, I can do it. I can, absolutely, I'll make it happen. But like,
why is he making that a note?
I've never thought about. Yeah. I'd never, because I just, oh, I play and I do my thing and that's cool.
Yeah.
Nope. It's easy if you're open to the conversation. It's easy. He's like, hey, make that note a little shorter. Oh, gotcha, boss. But it's like, wow. What about how long are all of my notes? Okay, let me start listening to what I'm actually playing each and every one and track it while you're going, like. And then that way, I'm an informed guy. I go into the control room and go, measure three of the second chorus. Let me check that out because it felt weird. And then, oh, no, it's fine. Or I gotta fix that. But no one else hears it but you because you've learned to listen. How consistent do I need to be? How consistent am I? All this information. That's my superpower that I want to try to work on. Through my whole career, I still want to unlock the mysteries of harmony in every note that I ever hear and make sure I can achieve it on the bass. But there aren't as many places I can use that to great effect that I can use this listening power, this interpretation power.
Of course, yes.
Every time we go to fill in for somebody, you want to be as good as, if not better, than what was left for you.
Yes.
And that's so hard, you know. but if you're not up for that, then why are you saying yes? Why would you do the gig?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Mr. Hurley, you are a true ambassador of the bass. You're just sort of like spewing wisdom. I'm like,
it's amazing. It is.
Well, I appreciate it. When I'm around you guys, I just feel like these are my people. This is the passion.
You are home.
Yes.
Oh, it's so great.
Are we aliens? Do we belong somewhere else?
I don't know, maybe.
Okay. We belong right here. It's all good.
It's all good.
I mean, now we have something else for you, Sean Hurley. We've got I Don't Trust Myself.
Another favorite.
And there's this legendary story of the session, right? Where maybe you know these details of Pino and Willie Weeks being booked on the same day. Was that a mistake?
No, I know everything about this. Do you want to play it first and then let me? Or
yes.
I know as
yeah.
much.
Let's,
yeah.
let's
I know a lot about it. I don't know everything, but I know a lot about it.
Amazing.
Let's listen to it and then jump in. Here we go.
So the live in LA, we've got De La on this.
Right. So De La's doing the role of Pino. No, sorry, he's doing the role of Willie Weeks.
That's
Pino's
right.
Pino's doing the role of Pino, of course.
That's right. De La just holding down the chord changes and the eighth notes. Yeah. And then Pino with the offbeats.
But also, here, I have more intel for you, so I'll let it all rip. But man, what's wrong with this?
No, I'm not
nothing. This is just a bass song, right?
It is, yeah.
You can entertain an audience just drums and bass.
I mean, we've got to hear the story. We've got to hear the story about the session. And then, Sean, I feel like you had the dubious pleasure to, like, put those two things together.
Yeah,
and I've seen you do it, and it's crazy. So I can't wait to hear you talk about it, man.
This has multiple layers, and the chronology of it, I think, matters a little bit. But in the beginning, like I told you, I was working with the guy John Alasia, who had produced John's first record, and he was often having us work on other records at the Village, which is in Santa Monica in the LA area. And John was also doing a lot of Continuum there. So I had met John at this point, so I wouldn't really see him walking the halls, but I, you know, maybe would have occasion to bump into somebody working on the record, or he might be passing by. I was getting to know his band members. What had happened was, I think for Continuum, Steve had brought in Willie Weeks because they had done John Scofield, Ray Charles music record. Do you remember that one? And Mayer did I Don't Need No Doctor.
Yeah.
And that's Willie Weeks on that. So Steve brought in Willie, and Willie did a little bit of work, or maybe jammed or something. And he had recorded with John, so he was going to play on this song, but he was not available beyond a certain date, is the story I heard. This is all secondhand, so it needs to be corroborated. But I read in an interview that he had been previously booked to work with Greg Allman and was going to go out on tour. So, but there was a time where Pino and Willie were going to be in town together, and Pino was going to take over the John recording. Per Steve, this all comes through Steve Jordan, and he's really tight with Willie because he's played with him a ton, and Pino is also tight with Steve because they played together a ton.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
John always being open to things and being like, let's have them both play. So Willie held down the bottom, and it's just A, C, F, and it just goes A, C is always in the same spot, and the F changes the octave.
Ah, yes, and all on the E string, always.
For me, it is, until maybe you play it live and you want to expand, but to me, that's how I hear it, because I don't think the tone really changes. You'd have to ask Willie. He might have the ability to play the E and the A string and have us not know that he switched strings, because he's a Superman.
Yeah.
But then Pino was like, well, if you're doing the bass line, and I heard this from the engineer, who was like, so Pino's playing just the thirds. This is where, obviously, Pino knows all this stuff, but for the students out there, you know, chord quality, you hear what's happening, what key are you in? So obviously the A is going to be minor. You're in the key of C. You play a C, so you got the third up top, and then the F's got the A. And then he's doing, you know, he's doing like stuff like that with little, it's got little business.
Yeah, there's some business.
Yeah,
to it.
Right?
It's
like the Sly Stone stuff, you know, that's, to me, that's where his heart was. I never confirmed it with him, but that, to me, that's what I hear. It's like, oh, that's some Sly, you know, how do you make it? And that's why I like having, you know, there's no mute happening, because it's all, if you want to do that, but you can also, you're available. All the options are available to you. It's all, your hands will give you, I mean, this is brash. So,
yes.
So he's doing that. Then when they played it live, Pino was not on tour. So De La's playing the Willie Weeks part. And David Ryan Harris played a baritone guitar to do the Pino line.
Oh, amazing. I had no idea.
And what on the live video you're seeing, because it was a special concert, John played alone, then he played with the trio, then he played with the band. So David Ryan Harris is still in there playing the baritone and Pino. So they're having to be judicious with who's going pop, snap, crackle.
Yeah.
And De La just laying it down.
Right, just looking so happy to be it down.
To me, there's no better place on earth than having such a line. It's so simple and so beautiful, but so damn effective.
Yes.
You could play this, as long as you put a beat on, you play that bass line and everyone's like, hold on to whatever you find, baby.
Yeah.
They're just, they're going to be with you. They know what's happening.
Right.
Cut to then when I'm doing a tour and David Ryan Harris is not there. There was a tour I did with him and then a tour I did without him. And the question came, who's going to grab a baritone and play it? And we didn't have an extra guitar player that was going to jump into that. Zane Carney was playing guitar. Mm. Doug Pettibone was doing more pedal steel and slide stuff. So putting Zane on a baritone just to do snaps and pops seemed like a not the best use of his, what the voice he had in the band. So I said, well, like you, I'm sure all of you guys have done this, is you've heard that and gone, well, when I go do a gig and we cover this song, I don't have Willie or Pino at my disposal. So I just mocked it up. And I remember talking to the engineer who was doing the front of house. He's like, so what are we going to do here, fellas? And I said, well, I've messed around with this. Could this work? And I went. So he's like, cool. And then I'm like, can I do that thing?
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
I'll have to work on it a little more, but to get this little one while you're still strumming. So I would try to just cheat it with a little E, D, and then let the C just be happening.
The low. Ugh.
And then just some little...
Yeah, get the snaps in. Ugh!
Love it. Ugh!
And then you just... So then it was like, okay, it's going to be fine. We don't need to waste... another set of hands to do it.
Sure.
So I was like, yay. And I don't think it's ever come up again.
Oh my God. Do you, well, it made a big impression on me. I have to say, did anybody in the band, was anybody like, I mean, I just want a trophy. I want the confetti cannons to go off, dude. I want the trophy to come out and be like, we're giving you this trophy, Sean Hurley.
Being a problem solver, to have the engineer he engineered the records as well. So when he was like, what are we going to do? And I'm like, well, let me see about this. He's like, great, you solved it. Cool. I knew that was going to be like, that's the equivalent of getting, you know, and you get a new car. Just, he's like, great, I don't have to worry about this. Not a problem that needs to be solved anymore because you, Sean Hurley, have solved the problem.
Damn
it never
right.
even got past, you know, there was no committee involved. But it's nice to know that whatever, like, what do you need from me to make this song the best it could be? Because live, you're usually slicing and dicing. Like, we don't have, you don't want to play with tons of tracks in order to just make it sound fully. So everybody, a lot of the guitar players often have to do double duty. It was the one time where I could go, well, I'm capable of more than just drooling and playing one note at a time. So let me see. And lo and behold, it worked.
It's so great. I mean, to combine those two lines together, and I mean, you know, had to have made John Mayer happy, even if he didn't explicitly say it.
Right. It's like with any artist, when they don't, when they're used to something and you have to change it for whatever reason, and they don't have to look around and go, oh, it sounds like this now.
Right.
Is great. That's
UNF.
As a bass player, you take that. That's a win. Something yes. changed, but nothing changed.
Yes, yeah. yes, yeah. yes. Yeah. And then who needs Pino? Huh?
Right. or perhaps who needs me, or who needs yeah. Willie? It is, yeah. I took someone's job away.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's great. We're going to move on to Queen of California that came out on Born and Raised. Mm-hmm. I believe that record came out 2012. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Man, that's vintage now.
Oh, I know. And this is, now we're getting to some classic Sean Hurley on the record bass lines.
This is, yeah, you played I'm, on I'm this. Working, I'm logging my hours. Then John says, hey, I got a record for you. Going to New York and we're going to make some music together. Which
incredible.
Was a treat.
And this bass line is so wonderful. It's a first track on the record. I mean, I remember being so excited about this record. Sure. I'm from Montana. And so, you know, the country phase for me was really welcomed. I thought this was a super cool move. And I love that you were on bass. And this is new rhythm section. Oh, my right, God. Aaron right. Sterling on the drums. And oh, yeah. just such a big fan. So I devoured this music. And I love this bass line so much. So it's so fun to get to talk to you about it. Let's listen to it and then love for you to break it down.
Here we go.
I love him restarting there. Yeah. It's
and
great.
We're live on Google Hangout, you know, announcing yeah. a tour.
Oh, when you guys come in, look at him smile.
Yeah, right.
He's so happy that you're with him now.
Yeah, he's probably played this alone
goodbye
too many
cold.
Times.
Yeah. Goodbye rain. Goodbye sorrow. Goodbye shame. You know I'm heading out west with my headphones on. I'm boarding a flight with a song in the back of my soul.
This is a great freaking bass line, dude.
It's killing.
So beautiful.
And there's Don Was cheering us on and moderating.
Don Was just hanging out.
Yeah.
One on, one off.
Yep. Hello, beauty. Hello, strength. I'm busy looking for the sun to need young after the gold rush in 1971.
Ah, come on.
Yeah.
That little moment. Look at this bass.
I just found out a ghost left town. The Queen of California is stepping down, down, down.
Oh my God. Sean Hurley, look at you, man.
Just trying to keep it together.
I saw this and I was like, do I need a gray denim jacket and a plaid shirt now?
You might.
And a P-Bass and a B-15? Oh my God, man.
I think we actually all need a denim jacket and a plaid shirt. Yeah. Like, just to put it out there, I think that we do.
Just
so
great.
Good.
Funny.
I've seen, you know, I've heard this song a lot, and I've seen you play it a number of times, and I think this is one of the most deceptively challenging bass lines. It sounds so simple, and you make right. it look and sound so easy, and your economy of motion is so, I mean, your hand just looks like you're
I'm
just,
not doing anything.
You're not doing a damn yeah. thing, you know, and that's when you know there's an assassin in the building, you know?
Don had picked up on that, but I had a teacher early on that was like, man, let the amp work. Don't be, because there's a lot that you might want to be doing at any moment. So make sure you're ready for anything. It's always like, you know, I guess the Assassin's Creed, you know, if you're a ninja, like you're not just standing, if you don't want to be pushed over. If someone comes and bumps into you, you're not moving. So I just, practice. I was always a good student. So if someone told me something in earnest, I would go, all right, that's something important. I'm going to try that. It's hard, you know, to not lift your fingers off the neck, that right. the ones that aren't being employed at the moment. But I just made a point of it. It also made muting easier. But when yes. I play a B, I'm here. When I play an E, I'm here. And I play an A, I'm there.
Right.
So 7th fret, I'm just right there.
Yeah. When your hand doesn't even have to move.
No.
Right?
Thank you.
those sneaky ghost notes too, man.
And that's what it all, it's like, we talked about this ghost note business. It pairs with the drums. It keeps everything churning, but it doesn't attract the wrong kind of attention to me. Because everything in that guitar thing is percolating. The drums, he just starts doing essentially a march kind of thing. And then it's up to me, how do I keep it churning? So I didn't, you know, this is where it helps make the note length be very effective because I'm going to stop, but I'm going to keep us moving by doing the ghost notes. And I was always looking for a tax man, you know, come together, inner city blues kind of bass line. If I can do ostinato stuff that's got that, if the flat seven's available, you know how good that stuff feels. Oh. And again, this is to take a page out of No Such Thing. I'm like, no thirds. I didn't want... Because he's doing a B thing, but it's kind of walking down with the A and then the E over G sharp. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of a classic songwriter folky kind of thing. And nowhere while the... See her... The melody has the D sharp in it, but if I did, we'd be like, nope, next. What else you got? So then you hammer home this other stuff, and any of my pivots are all. This is where the dumb side of me comes right into play, or the Duff McKagan, like no thirds, so just fourths and fifths, E to F sharp.
Yes.
You pepper it with a little bit of, you do a full McCartney and a half McCartney and a three quarters McCartney and just keep it percolating.
Sean, did you write that bass line? Like,
yeah.
Did you...
Oh, yeah. John just started playing this line.
Yep.
Until it became this progression, it was just that little vamp on B doing his thing.
Right.
And I just heard. There's a big B and a big A, and then it kind of tickles at the E. So I was like, what's the easiest way? This was heaven for me to go. I've always wanted to write a McCartney line, and rarely do you get the moment to do it. And I was just like, great. My first spot is the B root note, and then land on that A. He's already moving off from it, so I'm hitting the E, and I just started rolling. This is what doing sessions, you know, multiple days a week. It's like, how creative can you be with the simplest ingredients and make it something that the song then suddenly can't live without? Because when I hear people cover or do things and they don't play that line, I get a little like, huh. It doesn't sound like the same song.
Right. No, I mean, it's integral. I mean, it's a big, big thing. And I was always wondering too, you know, I feel like sometimes I would be inclined or I would want to play the B here and maybe the A here, but you don't do it, right? You're all in this zone.
Because this is where, you know, just experiencing in the room with somebody versus... Yeah. Hearing it later and going, oh, what are the chords? Like, it's just being hit at me, and he's playing a B here, but his A is up here. So I want to flow with him. And then this is that melodic range. That's melodic, but it still is fundamental and fortifying for the song. But because he's staying up there, sometimes the further you spread, the less effective it gets, the less like glued. It doesn't mix wise. It doesn't really gel. So then you're looking for, well, what are we going to put in the middle to put it all, to keep it all flowing together.
Right.
And it kind of came out and he liked it. And then once we started adding chord changes, at one point we just rolled through a blues. That wasn't quite right, but it's essentially a blues. He just has, he changed the turnaround from being the five, and we have, you know, he goes through the four, adds the C sharp, but that's essentially functioning as just the four chord would in a blues, and then you're back to the one.
Yeah. And oh, then so great.
We even tried other chord changes, and then one day I was like, you know what? Just out of golf left town, is down. Just make it a blues at the ending.
Ugh.
And I've played a lot of blues, and I've always looked for, man, these lines, they're so good. They're so, you know, me and my friends always called that the line, and then we had the reverse line.
Right.
That stuff's in my vocabulary. It's like, if I can make a meal out of that on a pop song or a, you know, songwriter song, that is, it's like taking candy from a baby.
Right.
And babies are weak. You just grab
it. Give me that candy.
Yeah. Like something I want to point out as well, that just in case anybody's missed it, is when you play, so your right hand has got this kind of like this home zone. When I'm watching you play with anybody, like your hand always goes to this very particular area on the bass. And sometimes you do move up and down, but you have got this sort of like this like area that you go to. And I think that at least when I play a little.
Totally.
A little bit back. And it just never sounds as good and as fat as when you're playing it.
This is where the tonal, like, I made choices because, again, I played a lot of different basses when I was learning, and I'd sometimes hear recordings back. And if you were in just bass, drums, guitar land in a singer, the minute the guitar player started soloing or doing something that wasn't chordal, and I heard it back, and anytime I was trying to imitate Jaco from his instructional video jamming with Scofield, I did that on a recording I made with my blues band, and I heard it back, and I was aghast because to me there was no, we lost everything. So I started going.
Got it.
And then it's like, okay, that's the tone. Like, because I was stuck with what I was stuck with. I didn't have, I always ended up being with bass, drums, and guitar. That was it. We were in a small town. Mm-hmm. You'd lose one guitar player, get another. We never had enough sound where I could make different choices. So I slowly slid up, and you could see this bass is well worn right
in
there.
That zone.
That's my zone. And I'm eating away at the wood. With my thumb in my thumbnail.
Oh. Right.
And you play really lightly as well, don't you?
Yeah. I used to be like, hey, your P bass light and your you know, you play light. I used to put those two together as like a man, am I not strong? Do I end up playing light? But again, it was that teacher who was like, let the amp do the work.
Yeah.
And I found that when I played live, especially like Vertical Horizon, we're playing in a bigger venue, and I get my moment, and I'm so excited, and I start digging in, and it's like, I can't even play an eighth note, let alone a 16th note. So I would practice so much to go, I need to maintain complete calm. Hmm. The same when I'm in my practice room has to be the same live. Otherwise, I cannot play. I can't do that if I'm going.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, well, I can't play hard. Then I have to play light. That I just have to do it. And then I also noticed when I do this just the right amount, the wave is bigger. The sound is bigger. If I do this.
Yeah, you lose all the bottom.
Not a lot of sub there. So I found I'm always searching for the sweet spot of it. Some basses are different depending on the tension. If you could, you know, you can hit a little harder if the string tension is a little harder. But I've always found playing lighter, turn up the amp a little more, and it's just you have.
We literally had this conversation either yesterday or the day before with Gary Willis.
We did.
And then And 2 weeks, 2 weeks before that, Michael League, and they both said the same thing.
They did.
Play really lightly. When you look at the waveform, you're going to see big sausages rather than traffic cones.
Exactly. Right?
Exactly. You're going to get all of this fat note rather than all the front end, and then
attack.
It just dies off.
Yes, right.
Yeah, exactly. And then nothing else afterwards.
And then nothing.
Yeah.
And again, a lot of my work ended up being... The start of it kind of was when the computer age started, so I could see the effectiveness of if I gotta hit a note and it's gotta hold, because I'm playing with a singer, so it's gotta hold for two beats, four beats. If you hit it hard and it dies off quickly, it's perceived as you muted yourself before the next chord.
Right.
And that, you know, and the as I'm learning and like maybe hit one note too loud, and to see that and to hear it was like, that's disgusting. I can't do that.
That's so great. Oh,
so,
man.
So ballad practice. And again, it's like we take all these little bits of like, who encouraged us? Who told us we were on the right path? Who corrected us when we were veering? The first time I recorded with Vertical Horizon was the first time I recorded with a producer, a record label, a real budget. We're at a place called Bearsville. Jeff Buckley did his record there. The band did a ton of stuff there. This is Woodstock, Bearsville, New York, near Woodstock. And I was playing a song where the artist wanted me, the singer Matt wanted me to play with a pick, and he wanted just downbeats, and I was playing... And I was doing it for a long time, and nobody in the band, the producer, engineer, didn't say anything, but the assistant, who was kind of in charge of getting things into the computer, he's like, man, I know you're really good because you're hitting all of those notes perfectly, and they are all consistent, and they all sound the same, and he's like, you're nailing it. I know you're playing, you know, he called them whole notes. He's like, I know you're only playing whole notes, but I know you're awesome. And that was all I needed to hear. I was like, man, that's all I need.
Man. That's so nice. Just a little affirmation from the engineer. God, it's all we ever want.
I probably had 10 years of joy after that moment. But to have that level of critical awareness, I was hardly aware of it. But to go, okay, that's it, because I'm having the new experience. Oh, this is a big studio, big budget, and to have somebody go, your preparation is appreciated here. It's like making a free throw in basketball. Like, hey, man, I know it's easy, but when it's crunch time and we're down by 1 point and you've got two free throws, if you make both of them and we win. So I did not take that for granted. The fact that I still remember it. I've forgotten so many other stories where I worked so much harder. I was like, yeah, that's really cool. Later. But this was like, wow, okay.
Hmm.
When you do that, the tone, the intensity, the consistency, it all comes into play. And it will ultimately, I think, lead you to the next job.
Absolutely.
Hey, before we jump into the next track, what about the bass on that last clip as well? Because that's not what you're playing now.
Right. Yeah. That one I've semi-retired because as it's aging... There's some things like I have to deal with a little fret thing here, or like I feel like the pickup's changing, but that is my 61 P bass, straight from the factory, slab board, you know, sunburst. Indeed. It's well worn. I bought it in like 2009, so got 14 years ago. I bought it to do the tour with John that Steve Jordan was playing drums on because he hadn't met me yet. Pino was unavailable because he was playing with The Who, so I got the call to tour, and Steve said, I don't care who's coming in, and the crew, I had already toured with John, so the crew was like, oh yeah, Sean's great, it'll be great. He's like, he's got to have a P bass with flats and an SVT, and I had those things, but what I wanted was a P bass with flats that I didn't have to worry about getting off the road and back into the studio, like this other one I was using, which was my 66. So I said, let me go buy one that'll be a special touring bass. Cut to, I'm playing it, and it's like, I went into True Tone Music in Santa Monica. I saw it online. I played it and was like, this has to be my bass. And it became, wow. So then I, of course, I did have to rush it home after every tour and get it. Yeah. I just fell in love with it. I felt like this was the bass that was meant for me. I put flats on it. They got broken in quickly by being on the road. I also hit him with Vaseline, which is my trick.
That's your move.
That one is what they measured and copied and did all the deets on to make this. That's the copy. This is the signature bass of that 61. So that way I could leave it at home and I could play this one. And I also have a couple other colors, and Fender's still selling it 10 years later.
That's
which
incredible.
Is kind of shocking.
And you're a LaBella guy, right?
LaBella flats. Yeah. And that's what, you know, I noticed Pino's bass came with Tomastics. So I knew that I could offer up, hey, if you'd make the bass and you going to make it for sale, please, please put LaBellas on it, because I feel like they're married perfectly. 43 to 104. So just a hint lighter than the 45 to 105. But you remember, this is 0.105. So by changing to 0.104, it's like a thousandth of a
yeah.
numeral.
Pretty
you
small.
Know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But
yeah.
it
yeah.
makes all the difference. It was directed by a friend that used them and also the guys at LaBella. And then when I left Fender, I got a call from the LaBella guy, and he's like, hey, man, thanks for hooking us up with Fender. They bought 50 sets. So I knew they were going to make a lot of basses and sell them. And, oh, and when the guy made
amazing.
It, he said, I love this bass with the LaBellas on. And he said, I don't think if we just put on our usual brand, the tension is different and it would have played differently. And he's like, You're right about it. This bass, like when you put those strings on a Fender P bass and you play like me, you know, light enough so that you're not killing it, it's like it's a perfect match.
Yes. So fat, round.
Yeah. But that clip was from 2013. So the bass was 10 years younger, and I used it exclusively on the road because I hadn't even gotten this bass yet. It was in production, but it hadn't even been built yet.
Wild. I can actually remember watching that video when it only had something like 3,000 views. Like when it like the first week.
Right.
I can remember checking. Yeah, I can remember checking it out. I can remember where I was living. I can remember. It's embarrassing to say I was about to get in the bath. So let me just put it out there. I might have been naked.
That's encouraged.
I was in the bathroom, bath was going, yeah. I was running the bath, I was watching the video, just to let you know.
Oh, thanks for letting us know, Scott, that's great.
I'm feeling steamy now.
Okay, should we jump into the next one before I talk about being naked anymore?
Yeah, we've got Last Train Home up now from Saab Rock. This is 2021, and I was like, you know, Sean, which one should we check out? And he said, you know, they're almost all the same because you did these in studios during COVID, which of course you did.
Yep.
I wasn't even thinking about that though, right? You did three of these performances,
yes,
right?
Yeah, we did one for each of the late night guys, and none of them would let us come in. So we did the soundstage at Henson Studios, and we did do it over 3 days. And I can't remember if we did anything, because we did even a couple other things. We did a hit for the Today Show, which was like a fourth thing. But over 3 days, we just ran each song so that they would each be unique. But in my wheelhouse, I was like, I'm playing it by the record. I'm
sure.
Doing it, you know, I'm not going to go for anything fancy for the Kimmel show, and you know, so
and something
all,
different for another
yeah,
one. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were in the zone. We were there for one purpose.
Well, I chose this one, the Today Show one, because I like how Aaron's snare sounds in the top better than the other two. It's got the character of what I wanted to hear from it. I was like, oh, the tune starts out with just this great beat from Aaron Sterling, and then the band comes in. Are you playing your Sig bass on this too?
Yeah, I have three of them because they made a Sunburst, a White, and a Gray. And that one I put rounds on because I didn't feel the need to have three basses. And when we did the video, Scott, in New York, I had my Sunburst one with the flats that keep on the East Coast. So I only have two of these here, and that White one is my round wound, you know, go out and do anything that needs rounds. And then I keep the bass I recorded the song originally on, I have here with me. It's my Sunburst 66, but it does have rounds. So I definitely wanted to give it the rounds treatment.
Oh, cool. And is this then rounds on the record? What bass did you play on the record?
Yep, I've got it here. It's a 66 P bass sunburst with round rounds. I'll pull it out for our a little, you know, our chat about it.
Oh, yeah, great. Okay, cool. Let's check this tune out. That snare.
This, so good, so good. This is the beauty of doing it and then turning it in. Is we had Chad, John's engineer, mixing it while we're playing.
Oh, wow.
So just getting that tone.
If you wanna roll me,
it sets the scene.
Then you gotta roll me out. If you wanna use me, then you gotta use me till I'm gone. I'm not a fallen angel, I just fell behind. I'm out of luck and I'm out of time. If you don't wanna love me, let me go. I'm running for the last train. For the last train home. If you wanna know me,
Sean, were you
what a great chord sequence.
Just to put it out there.
It just seems so pleasing, doesn't it?
It like, really does.
A lovely chord sequence to play around.
Yeah, it's that's where it started for him, because we recorded this together. Live, you know, at the same studio during the COVID era. So John had us camped out. He was coming up with the concept of his Saab Rock record, and he wanted to have something different. Like, he doesn't have anything in his wheelhouse that kind of moving the chords, very diatonic, but it's just moving in a way that's like, no, I don't have anything like this. Very synth bass. And that's all we had as the tune when we first started. And then, like John always does, it's like, okay, I'm going to just put in some extra puzzle pieces, and then the minor sequence came in with the C sharp minor. And it just feel like, again, there's nothing wrong. Like, nothing that just makes me feel like, great, I heard a song that's at peace with itself. It's not trying to be something, it's not trying to poke its elbows out. It's like, so, but a lot of it was, he's like, I'm gonna be looping this, so y'all got to move and do something. And Aaron's like, well, I'm playing a drum beat, so you're it. And I just had to, and he complimented me on making it move and groove. He's like, you're the propulsive engine in this one, which is usually not the case with a typical John Mayer song. It's like, and it's full improv. I'm playing what I did on the record as much as I could, because I'm like, I gotta be patient to use the right octaves at the right time, and then don't go too far too soon.
Right.
Because I have limited options in terms of the growth. So I got to save something here or there. But so I'm doing a lot of hovering around. And then I said, I can't go up to the high A yet. And I'll just hover around in the dusty end, or the murky end. This is the dusty end. I'm in the murky zone, so even though I'm pivoting off A's and G sharps, it's not disrupting the flow, which typically, this I guess is where Jameson, using his half step stuff, which you would stand out if I lingered too long, I can't do that, but I can go, just bouncing around, so that the pitch is less important than the rhythmic element of it. And John had purposely said, like, don't stay still. You got to keep this thing bopping.
Oh.
And there were just the three of us. He and we had a friend of ours playing keys, but that, you know, that was not going to change. Again, it was just like, someone's going to get the task of, you've got to vary what you're doing because everyone else is static.
Well,
it's tricky, right, isn't it?
Yes.
Sorry, and I was just going to say, it's tricky, isn't it, when somebody says, hey, like, play, like, we want you to be the propulsion, pushing it along. We want you to play quite, you know, busy-ish. but you know that you also can't get in the way of the harmony. Like, you need you need to be neutral, you know.
Right. The propulsion needs to be there. That's the best word. I was looking for the neutral movement that would not distract, but it would just keep pushing the thing up the hill so that when we hit the and he even commented on, I should grab the bass that I played it on, because the tone, I think this would have been a tough sell on a flat wound bass, which is why I didn't even attempt it.
Grab the bass.
Yeah. So this is the one, this is actually more of my workhorse in my regular day job of playing bass on come what may. I tend to use this bass. Lady A, you know, Gwen Stefani, all the stuff, most of the names you mentioned, I would have played this bass on.
Wow.
And this is the one that sold me completely on, I have done country records, I have done R&B records, I have done ballads, I've done film score stuff, and this bass has never gotten fired from it.
Wow, right. Oh, and, wow. And what year is this?
This is a 66.
Yeah.
And a lot of my friends have a 66 have talked about the fact that even when they've just randomly bought a 66, the consistency of the bottom end. The reason I know I can trust it in any genre is it's got so much low end. I played it on a Lil Nas X song that's not yet out, but it can compete with any of the things where, hey, we've got subs or we've got a lot of things going on. We got electronics going on, synths going on. This guy seems to be able to do it. And this was the bass I was playing when the producer said, where's your tone? And I had it pulled back a bit, and he wanted it all the way up. That said, I have strings on this. They're rounds, but I haven't changed them. I recorded the John record in 2020. They were old then, and I haven't changed them since.
Wow.
So they could
be rounds. Cool.
6 years or so, but there's a lot of crispiness that when a compressor gets a hold of that or a Neve gets a hold of that, it's like, but it's not zingy. It's not
zingy at all.
There's no active bass zing, but there is some harmonic stuff up there.
Yes.
So when I went, bah, bah.
Yeah.
And it's stuff like that. Like, I landed a bump. That's only me going, baby, because I'm like, neutral zone. Where's the next strike?
Right.
And I just keep spinning it around. Because that's gonna pop out the minute I play that octave A. I better mean it, because it really pokes out in the way that the other neutral zone stuff doesn't really attract the same kind of. What are you doing over there?
And then
if you save it for, it's not in the intro, it's not in the first half of the verse, but then the second half of the first verse, and then John specifically commented and said, "I like what you did." We came out of the, you know, just rolling around. And then we're going to go to the next section, which also starts on an A. So as a player, I'm like A to A, terrible. You know, you can't, damned if you do, damned if you don't. So I just went. Yeah. Fallen angel.
Yes,
and he liked that when he heard our first take, he's like, great, that works. Keep doing that in there. So every time we played it, I would always lead into that section with. But then I could chill because we're doing chord changes. Not enough, but I'm out of time.
Yes.
Dun, dun, dun. like pressure's off, then
right.
Ba, ba.
And back.
And then, you know, that's where we could start doing other things. And then my only other moment where, again, this is the simplest stuff. We train for, we're swinging two bats and then we get out and we're playing T-ball. But I'm looking at like, how do I develop? So the song goes. Right. So I know the harmony and I go, oh, how about if I do some substitutions, which if you do them too soon, everyone hates you. But if you do them on the fade out, everybody
yes.
loves you.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
I That's right. Back That's so true. Down. Yes.
And John was like, I like that. So I did it again. I do it twice at the end. And then every time we played it live, I would do it because that kind of rounded us home. You knew you were rounding the turn and yeah. you're about to enter the driveway.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, and you talk about two bats and then it's T-ball, but it's not T-ball. And I know you know that. I mean, you're being sure, modest, but it is not T-ball. It's so intentional. It's more like chess. I mean, you know, it's like,
you're probably right. Right.
It's simple, but oh man, there's so much strategy involved in patience, right? Because it's so easy just to come out and play all your stuff and all your ideas early. And then you're like, damn. And like you say, if you substitute and you fill early, people are annoyed. They notice it, but not in a good way. You don't establish trust, right?
That's it. And it can be that way in every day. Like tomorrow, if I do a session, I do need to establish trust that the guy knows I'm not in it just for myself.
Right.
So I'm in it for the team. And then when the team needs more out of me, like we got two guys on base, like, can you steal? Can you go from second to third and can you steal? Like, I can do that. So you don't get on first and then immediately try to steal second.
Like, right.
Let's pace ourselves. This is the stuff you glean from years of just doing it. And sometimes it's spoken, sometimes it's unspoken. But I do think it needs to be said. And the way you said it, establishing trust, because each day, I just did a 3-day session and I haven't done 3 days in forever. Like a lot of times it's you're in and you're out in a matter of hours, if not a day.
Sure.
So the bond that you need to create with somebody new, whether it's a new artist, producer, or player, or sometimes all of those variables are all new. And it's you have to give them the trust of you're going to do the job and you're not going to make their job more difficult. By suddenly it's like, what's the chord? Well, you're playing a G sharp, but the chord's E. So which is it? Because if I play a G sharp, it's suddenly E over G sharp.
Right.
There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
That's absolutely right. Well, I mean, you also have made, when you came out and you were all over the internet and I was devouring any video I could find of yours, you planted the flag for the side musician in a way that I hadn't seen someone do before. And you talked about simplicity, you talked about time, you talked about note shape, tone from a side musician angle and from this song service point, and you made it cool. You have seemed to walk this line between, you know, on one side we have supportive, but the negative of that could be boring, right? You don't want to be boring. If you go too far on the other side, creative, then you're a wanker,
right?
And you don't want that, right?
You start to go, your lane to achieve both of these things is pretty narrow.
Yes.
How do you be cool, simple, and be like, oh, I want to have the guy that does so little we hardly notice him, but he's the coolest guy. The bass player can do it, but it has to be so intentional. It does not happen by accident.
And that's you, Sean Hurley. That's you.
I appreciate that.
The ambassador of bass. I'm telling you, it's the ambassador of bass. I'll get you a t-shirt. I'll send it over, Sean.
I would love that.
I am the ambassador of bass. Hey, guys, should we call this one there?
Yeah,
it feels
incredible.
Like we've done. Yeah, the conversation's been really fantastic. Sean, I do want to acknowledge that you are the ambassador of bass and that when I grow up, I want to be like you.
I encourage that because I need to leave the legacy to somebody, and neither of my children are interested in it. So if I could be passing
it on. I'll
be there. Plus, we need satellite offices for our ambassadors. We need them in the
Absolutely.
UK.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Hey, also as well, just for the listeners as well, just to let you know that we have also got a course in the SBL membership library from Sean, where we got to hang out in New York. And Sean was talking about all of these amazing tips for people that want to work in the session and studio world. So I really highly recommend going to check that out. If you're already a member at SBL, you've got access to it. If you are not, go grab a trial and jump into the course. It's really, really amazing. Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Next time.
My pleasure.
Take it easy, guys. Bye.